Actually, much of the work I'm going to talk about was sort of the result of sort of a collaboration with Bart Ehrmantraut, who was Jack Cowan's student. And it's sort of a trip to work with Bart. He's very, very funny, and he's very, very smart. And then all of a sudden he'll go, "David, I'm hungry." And he could be like in the middle of an integral, and he'll just stop. But we had some years ago become familiar with, as I'll sketch, the work of Kuramoto. And the idea was this idea of taking certain physical systems that you could put into oscillations, into limit cycles. And as long as they interacted weakly, which from a theoretical point of view meant they just nudge each other's timing in an infinitely tesimal amount on each cycle, but from a practical point of view, can actually push each other rather strongly and things seem to work out. This had a lot of appeal to us as sort of a metaphor for a lot of phenomena in neuroscience. And so there's a deep issue and an open issue, which is one that much of my lab works on now, which is that the central nervous system, the brain, okay, sort of consists of a series of loops. So I'll attempt to draw a picture while we wait for Eberhardt's picture. So we happen to work on the vibrissa system, and okay, so is that thing? But basically you have motor input. This could be the position of the eye. It could be the position of hairs. You have sensory output. This could be the photoreceptors. In our case, this could be the pressure sensors of the vibrissa. And already at the lowest level of your brain, the medulla, the part of the brainstem, this goes through a nucleus and it closes. Okay, this happens to be called the trigeminal nucleus in rats. Okay, now the problem though is that this projects again up through structures like the cerebellum, which are partly sort of midbrain, and a structure very similar to the colliculus that Jack talked about. And I'm leaving out the motor cells. And this again closes. And this projects up again into this area of thalamus. Jack talked about a lateral geniculate nucleus. And he talked about V1 or primary visual cortex. And then this will project down again. And so what happens is that sort of the stereotypical organization of the central nervous system is the idea of loops, is the idea of nested loops. And this, if you look at this as an experimentalist, if you just look at this, whatever you are, okay, the first thing you want to do is you want to say, well, as an experimentalist, I'd like to go in here with pharmacological scissors or even real scissors and isolate different parts of the nervous system and make progress on this. So in fact, this much, just within the last couple of months, we sort of got our technology together. We could isolate this much. It's sort of an interesting system that exhibits positive feedback, which is opposite from what you normally expect. If you look at the other systems, you have to ask yourself the following. Okay, I know I could go in. You could pretend, with all apologies to Steve Schiff, you could pretend you're a neurosurgeon and take out a vacuum cleaner and remove the cortex. And you can still find out you could teach animals to whisk, or you could teach animals to do visual identification.
Even a physicist could do that.
Even a physicist can do that, right? Well, there's a trick, actually. The trick is to use silver nitrate, right, to cut the bleeding. And but what this means is that different levels of control of organization in the brain can take over, okay, and it could come in and out. And this is not really understood. In fact, the only thing that is understood is some things that have to do with sort of brain activating centers. It's that, you know, like you think of Alzheimer's, you think of loss of this thing called acetylcholine coming into the brain, of these cholinergic centers, and they sort of keep the cortex from working. Okay, but basically has some idea of how these activating centers can turn on and off different regions, but how sort of higher levels of control could subsume control in these lower level loops, right, in a smooth way, right, is very much an open issue. And just thinking about how things could work smoothly immediately gets you thinking about weak coupling. So that was where our mindset was in coming into it, Okay. So despite all these lofty ideas of cortex and everything else, we're going to start, or try to start, a little lower. See, it's all Pierre's fault because your talk went too long. And it seems to be fine.
Yeah, it's there.
Oh, it's there. Okay. So I have to put mirroring on.
Just put mirroring on. We're ready to go. Okay. So what I'm going to try to describe is I'm going to pretend to be a theorist for a little while and describe some of the basic ideas of Kuramoto's model, the idea of weak coupling. And
how do you display it?
Just click on the go to that site, ITP Waiver.
Which viewer do you want to use? Adobe or
Adobe, anything Adobe. Adobe Acrobat.
This guy.
That guy. Yeah.
It's five, okay?
Okay. So I want to describe a little bit of background, play theorist, and describe I think some of the ideas that really come out of Kuramoto's work in describing weak coupling among cells. And the other appeal to it is that, oh great, okay, thanks a lot. Is while we were motivated to think about this as a sort of a theory that could provide a framework to understand many problems in the nervous system, we're also motivated to think of it because you'd like to be able to go from something we understand, which is the property of single cells, which Jack sort of sketched this morning, to this particular limit of understanding networks. And the only theory, there's only really sort of two approaches now where you could start with your detailed models of single cells and work to understanding network properties. The first, I think, is really in this weak coupling limit, where if the cells are at least going on as oscillators, okay, starting from an arbitrarily complicated model of a single neuron, you can derive, you know, both analytically and in the lab experimentally, okay, the one feature you need of that model, which is how it responds to perturbation from the outside world. So at least there's an intellectual thread, right, that takes you from single cells up through networks. And you could argue that you can understand single cells from channels. You could really sort of begin to build the kind of thread that at least one likes to do in physics. The other thing, which I'm not going to talk about at all, which is valid in the limit of very, very slow synapses, is work that was done sort of independently by Bart Armantrout and by Chaim Sampolinsky, okay, of developing mean field theories, okay, in the limit that the synapses are very slow. And it's really a mean field of describing the synaptic dynamics. Okay, so maybe this will I could give people references. Okay, so this is the gist of the talk. Okay, so I'm going to try to give a little bit of a theoretical overview of what's happening with the notion of weak coupling. And then I'm going to talk about experimental evidence for weak coupling among neuronal oscillators. And there's really two sort of important issues. One is, as I mentioned, there's a single feature one has to understand, which is how a neuronal oscillator responds to perturbation. Perturbation means primarily synaptic input from the outside. This makes it easy. There's very, very many state variables in a cell. Jack talked about the activation parameters of various channels. There's also ions that are governing these activation parameters. And there's voltage. Since the perturbations pretty much affect only voltage, not entirely, but pretty much only voltage, really we have to calculate the sensitivity function for sort of one of these degrees of freedom. After we sort of turn the crank and derive these various functions, you'd like to test it. And one way to test it is to compare with a measured function, which is somewhat embarrassing. It's only been done in one case. And if we're lucky, we'll make that all of two cases within the next year. And the second thing is I'd like to also talk about you get some non-trivial prediction about how pairs of neurons behave, okay, and particularly pairs of neurons that just try to inhibit each other. And there's some beautiful unpublished data from Barry Connors, who very graciously gave me his data. So I'll try to show that. And I think, just to sort of jump to the punchline, is that at the level of pairwise interactions, at the level of simple networks, you find out that I think this theory sort of has something to offer. And you couldn't have said that 10 years ago in neuroscience. So that's a positive thing. Okay. Then we're going to move on to systems and sort of get away from single cells, but look an aggregate behavior, if you will. Again, it bears somewhat when Jack talked about this morning. I'm going to talk about large-scale phenomena. I'm going to talk about the existence of waves, of electrical waves, in two systems. One is the olfactory organ of a land slug whose worldview is dominated by odor. I think poodle should also go in this category. Okay. And the other is what happens within the visual system itself, and these are actually going to be dynamic measurements. I'm going to talk about waves within the visual system during normal vision. And this all sort of these generic features. I think at the lunch conversation, Pierre alluded to sort of generic features you'd have. So sort of linear waves and rotating waves will appear. Okay, I'm sure we'll be out of time at that point, but if someone would like to ask a question, there's some recent experiments, actually, which Herb Levine, who runs part of this program, contributed to. And I'll try to talk about how you actually get nonlinear mixing, much like in your radio, okay, within neurons. And the importance of that is that in sensory motor systems, there are signals that sort of tell you where your limb is or where your eyes are, and there are actual contact signals. And if you want to understand position in body-centered coordinate, you sort of have to combine these two. And this sort of had some, at least for us, some unexpected results. Okay, so let me start. Hey, Eberhardt, thousands of dollars for a laptop. You know, get it right to the NSF. Okay, so let me just explain what we are talking about. I mean, I want to focus on waves. And there are sort of some trivial waves, like light bulbs in the marquee in the movie theater, to the extent that these things still exist. And you can get that in trivial ways just by having a string of light bulbs and having a single generator and just having various delays, you know, linearly increasing or just monotonically increasing delays from one light bulb to the next. Okay, so that's not what I want to talk about. That's in some sense trivial. And the other thing is that you could just, again, have a media with a, you know, sort of non-infinite or finite propagation rate. And again, you launch a pulse and it just moves along. And this is, you know, appropriate for thinking about some things, at least fronts moving in epilepsy, but it's not what we're going to talk about. I do want to focus on our systems and where you have autonomous oscillators. And in some sense, in the laboratory, you can prove that you have autonomous oscillators. And these oscillators are coupled. And it's the nature of the coupling that will cause a certain phase relationship between these oscillators. Okay, so if you combine this sort of phase relationship with these oscillations going up and down, you just have a front that's moving across. So this is the focus of the kind of system we're looking at, and this sort of guided our thinking. And so in order to detect this kind of phenomena in neurobiological systems, I mean, you inherently have to measure at many points. I mean, and you could, in principle, build up a view from making, you know, multiple two-point measurements again and again. But this is sort of a practical problem. I mean, as you see, many of the phenomena I discuss is you trigger the system with the appropriate stimulus, and it runs, and it produces waves or produces rotating waves. And from trial to trial, you get basically the same kind of statistics, but you don't exactly get the same waves. So the notion of trial averaging, okay, the notion where you can just repeat a stimulus over and over again and just average on a time response doesn't exist. Okay, so in practice, that means you have to make many measurements at the same time. So this requires lots of electrodes or some kind of imaging modality. Okay. So in some cases where imaging has been applied, this is the list of places where people have seen waves is small, because it really turns out to be the list of places where people have actually, you know, applied imaging techniques. So, and if you notice, most of the places that have showed these sort of long-range waves are places without blood, okay? And there's a reason for this. And this is because the kind of measurements that Jack alluded to this morning, these like voltage-sensitive dye measurements or intrinsic imaging measurements on mammals, actually have a contamination from physiological noise in blood flow, which is often an order of magnitude larger, if not more, than the kind of signal you get from a voltage-sensitive dye. And it's so the tide is changing a little bit, but the examples I will take, right, are mostly from animals in which we could remove the blood and replace it with some kind of artificial oxygenated solution. So that works well with invertebrates, and it works well with lower vertebrates, and it works not so well with rats. Okay, so I'm just sort of biasing. Nonetheless, I will talk a little bit about just from viewpoint measurements, what's been seen, particularly within the cat visual system. And in fact, even from just 2 and 3 point measurements, one already gets the sense that there might be some very rich phenomena going on. Okay.
Practical point, because earlier in this workshop, there were a number of presentations looking at mammalian cortex with intrinsic signal that had a lot of blood flow contamination in it.
Yes.
If you're going to study pattern development from those signals, what is it that we're looking at when we see that?
Okay, so let me take out a 1 minute aside.
Thanks.
Okay. So action potentials are a couple of milliseconds. But if you put action potentials aside for a second and look at the changes in the polarization state of single cells, that time is much slower. That time may be 100 milliseconds, maybe as low as tens of milliseconds, but not milliseconds. Okay. And so in pretty much everything I'm going to show today to the mammals, the time is kind of 100 milliseconds. We could argue where it comes from. It's probably the off time of the glutamate agonist onto NMDA receptors. It doesn't really matter. So that now blood flow response times from many, many labs, including our own, where we looked at red blood cells directly with optical sectioning, is you have response times that are about 400, 500 milliseconds. That's what you see in intrinsic imaging. So intrinsic imaging is inappropriate for the kind of dynamics that I'm going to show here. Okay, or even if you look at these electrical records, you need to use a voltage-sensitive dye or many electrodes or something to see it. If you're looking at things like ocular dominance columns that Jack talked about that morning, this is basically a steady state response, right? You're showing an animal grids like this, and you're asking what neurons are active. And then you're inferring that if the spike rate of the neurons go up, and maybe even more importantly, if the synaptic transmission in that region, okay, goes up, okay, then there's going to be an increased need for blood flow. Okay. Now, at this point, all hell breaks loose because, in fact, the oxygen level initially goes down, but then the oxygen level goes up, and the system overshoots. The hemodynamics actually overshoots. But despite the fact that it overshoots, this change in hemodynamics pretty much matches with the increase in electrical activity. So you're inferring from electrical activity to metabolism, from metabolism to increased blood flow. So
isn't it the case that there, at least for some fMRI studies with high field magnets in the 6+ tesla region, there are some reports that fMRI can basically confirm the intrinsic
Yeah, I haven't taken that data. Seiji Ogawa, who actually is a fellow who started this bowl of processing, talk about somebody who should have gotten the Nobel Prize. He has these beautiful plots of local field potential, which is some aggregate measure of synaptic activity versus a change. It's a mixture of a change in oxygenation of blood and a change in the perfusion rate of the blood. And so his data looks pretty linear. There was another paper by Nikos Lagathios that was published starting about 2.5 years ago. And his data looks pretty linear. And there was a third paper published by fellow Anders Dale, who I know, who's a pretty serious guy. And he actually says that the blood flow signals continues to overshoot the electrical activity. So, okay, it's sort of a brainless compendium. I'm not sure who to believe.
Before you turn off that slide, okay. could I ask you particularly about the 43rd stuff? How do you measure an actual wave there rather than just an oscillation at 40 hertz?
Which one are we talking about?
The bottom one.
Here?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll get to that. I mean, this is data, so that particular data, which comes from Ribery and Rodolfo Linas's entourage, was taken with MEG, so they had high-speed measurements across many points, right? And the only issue there was an issue of interpreting MEG, because
maybe you should say for some of the people here what MEG.
Oh, I'm sorry. MEG is magnetoencephalography. So you're using the fact that there's extra. Okay. The only reason you could, like, again, Jack talked this morning about the original Hubel-Weasel experiments, and these are experiments where you put a wire had insulation everywhere except at the tip. Now, you're actually not recording what's going on in the cell, but because different parts of the cell are at different potentials, okay, you're recording the current flow between these different parts of the cell, okay, during an action potential. Okay, it's just to say that the internal length of the cell is you know, during an action potential could be very short, like 10 microns. So the electrode is looking at a difference in potential, or really the currents that are flowing during the action potentials. Okay, and so the same currents in a structure of neurons that have some spatial organization, of course, will lead to an electric field. So that's what you're measuring. Okay. Any?
Yeah. Oscillator is a group of cells, not a single cell.
Correct. I'll show some data that supports this, right? Okay, so in this case, so this is experimental evidence in large scale. So all I'm trying to say is that every time we've been able to look carefully, you know, just, and it's really been a technical issue, right? You sort of find that there's some rich patterns.
So you have a last question, sir.
Okay.
So you mean the phase gradient means pi over 2 means not more 2 waves in the field?
Yes. So it's never, I don't know of any system. And I did leave one out, which is due to Bob Lemon and the motor system, which was just published. And it's you never get more than about pi, right, phase gradient. You never see the same phase twice in the same field.
So I can see that in slides.
Okay, but I said it at the beginning, I'm not focusing on epilepsy. Okay.
So yeah. Can you explain this a little bit more? I mean, in every one of these experiments, you have a stimulus that induces the wave, and then you have
a... Okay, I'm actually going to go through a bunch of these in detail. So like things like the mollusk olfactory system and the turtle olfactory system, it's free running. The stimulus comes on, and these waves are just going. Okay, so they have a pretty good frequency. But they're not stimulus triggered. They're not locked to. You're not going with a shock and then seeing a phenomena. It's just a normal running state of affairs. Or in the case of the olfactory system or the turtle visual cortex, it's a normal running state of affairs in the presence of a stimulus. But it's not locked to the stimulus onset. Okay, that's in my mind what makes it interesting. Like you think it may have something to do with the computation.
So, but it's okay. Actually a propagating wave. It's not just a bulk oscillation.
It's a propagating wave. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'll do the pies. Yeah. Okay. So what did you say before? This is an autopsy or a dissection or?
Steve said that. Autopsy.
Autopsy.
I used to do autopsy.
Okay. That seems like a dissection because I'm still alive. Okay, so let's play theorist for the moment. Okay, now Pierre gets his chance to dig his heels in. Okay, so this is the basic idea. You have an oscillator, right? Which means that you have, you know, in a nerve cell, there's many, many currents. Okay, like a cell in the thalamus may have 14 identifiable state variables that describe it. But despite the complexity, is that if you go in with an electrode and you inject a constant current into the cell, it's just repeating. The waveform is repeating itself over and over again. So within this sort of very complicated space, or high-dimensional space, it's a little bit like a roller coaster, just to use a colloquial example, is that it always comes back to the same spot. Then you go around again, and it always comes back to the same spot. So the idea is, at least if I sort of, you know, stay on this limit cycle, or stay on the tracks, I could make little tick marks, and I could just ask, where am I on the limit cycle? And the importance of this is that it provides a nice way to understand how two cells could interact, because if they're if they want to phase lock together, then they're sort of pushing each other, so they tend to go around their limit cycles together. And if they want to be out of phase, then they tend to push each other apart. Okay. So what I really want to do is I want to understand is that if I'm on this path and I give a little kick that pushes me off the path by perturbing one of the state variables, which means injecting a little bit of current into a cell and perturbing the voltage state variable, or injecting a little, or maybe doing something to turn on inositol triphosphate and give it some calcium and perturb that state variable. I want to do something, and it pushes me off this path, right? And then the way to judge how sensitive I am to that perturbation is just to wait till I recover, okay? And to ask, am I phase advanced or phase retarded from where I would have had to have been if I hadn't had the perturbation? Okay, so that's the key idea. This is sort of Kurmota's key idea. Okay, that you're going around the limit cycle, and at every point in the limit cycle, I could give a little kick. And then I could ask, so I end up being ahead of myself in the absence of a perturbation or behind myself. So you could kind of understand how you could do this even brute force experimentally, just if you had to run your model on a computer. There's some more clever ways. And you could also understand how you could do this in the laboratory. You could have the system going. You could inject a perturbation, like a little bit of charge, and then ask, do I fire before I was expected to or after I was expected to? Okay, so what ends up at the end of the day is, assuming we could actually make derive this perturbation, okay, then what I could do is I really have reduced all the dynamics of a cell to just this one variable, which is the phase, which is where I am on the limit cycle. And then I want to see if I could write an equation then for the phase. Okay, and intuitively then I just want to write it as the fact that the phase is just evolving with some frequency in the absence of perturbation, so the cell is just firing at a regular rate. And then I just have perturbations coming in from all my neighbors. And then can I write this in a way that the only thing that matters is the phase difference between my neighbor, which is J, index J, and myself, which is index I. Okay? And I'll just run through this, and Bart and I have a little article together that reviews this. But basically, I'm going to show that, at least for neurons, I could write this coupling, this interaction, in terms of, I should say in general, I could write this coupling in terms of how the sensitivity, my sensitivity to whether I'm retarded or advanced, okay, dotted into a perturbation. Okay, and since I'm only going to really be concerned with voltages, this is going to just turn out to be the product of two scalars. Okay, so that's the idea. This is the general idea. So if you buy into this, then we can just...
That becomes a function of the difference between two variables you choose the
appropriate data. Yes. So let me go through that. Okay, I'm just going to sketch it. Again, this is not my work. This is, you know, published already, you know, from the 70s, from Kurmota.
Is it assumed that the motivation anything to be short, or why do I able to come back to my original limit point?
Okay, so from a theoretical point of view, you're winning this, you know, there's always a little epsilon in front of the perturbation, and you're assuming that the epsilon is small enough. So the perturbation comes on, and then it goes off, right? So it's not clear that I have to come back to the limit cycle.
But you're assuming that this is a state limit cycle.
Yes.
And therefore, for a small perturbation, by definition, it'll come back to the limit cycle, but its phase might be...
Yeah, these are all phase resetting curves.
Right. Right. Well, period. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So it's kind of fun. Okay. So again, not to get too pedantic about this, but again, so this is just repeating what I had on the previous slide, and I really need to look at. I really want to understand this, how the phase is perturbed, and if I just look at changes in voltage, I'm really just asking how the phase changes the sensitivity curve. Just ask me how the phase changes with in this case, voltage is adding a little current to the cell, okay? And if I don't put too much current in, I'm not changing the voltage by so much that the change in resistance of the cell matters. And this is just then the change in frequency with respect to the perturbation. And as I'll show in a second, we could do this experimentally. And the first person actually to do a very beautiful job on this was a fellow named Alex Reyes, now at NYU. And basically, what he would do is, He did the following kind of experiment. He had a cell that was free running, and it was going spike, and it was going spike, and then it was going spike. And what he would do is he would put a pulse in at a certain time, okay, since the last spike. Okay, if it had no effect, then this spike would come at its predicted period. Okay, and if it slowed down the cycle, the spike would come later. If it sped it up, the spike would come earlier. Okay, and you would just do this for all possible values of this delay. Okay, and you'd build one of these phase resetting curves. I'll just focus on the bottom here. So in fact, the currents he put in were currents that sort of mimic the normal types of postsynaptic potentials that you would get. So he tried to do this with, you might say, biological realism. And he gets a curve that looks like this, just focusing on the bottom line. And let's see if this is reasonable. This basically says is that if the cell just fired an action potential, there's not much I could do to it. Right? Why can't I do anything to it?
Refractory.
It's refractory, right? The channels are open. The resistance of the cell is very, very low. The effect of the perturbation is minimalist. Okay, then, I mean, basically the channels are closing, the cell is resetting itself, and then my sensitivity continues to rise and continues to rise and continues to rise. At this point, all of a sudden, sodium channels have started to open up. I'm getting very close to the action potential. Okay, so we haven't quite reached the point where we've gone totally into positive feedback, but the channels are opening up. So again, the resistance of the cell is now dropping, and I again become insensitive. Okay, and so this is what one gets experimentally. It's just drawn shifted by half a period here. So this is where the action potential is occurring. So the fuzzy data points are taken from Alex Ray's experiments, and the dark curve was a calculation from a model of a motor neuron. And the one and only cheat, of course, is a scale factor. Okay, but I just want to show that you basically can calculate pretty well what you measure in the laboratory. So this made us happy, right? This was, you know, a cell with about seven degrees of freedom.
The frequency of the cell is increasing or driven by the current?
The frequency of the cell here is driven by a DC value of current. So that's, what is that faking? Okay. So on a motor, if you record from a motor neuron in the awake behaving animal, it has a tendency to oscillate, right? And a couple of people have found that, including Fortiger and I have a paper on this in rat. But it's not so pure. If you record from motor neurons like right before the organ, right, it's very regular. Okay, and one of the reasons it's regular was something actually this fellow Huesgaard first discovered is that, you know, when you're awake, you're this thing called the Raphe nucleus in your brainstem is sort of gives you posture. It turns on all the cells and makes them fire regularly. This turns off when you're sleeping, right? It keeps you from kicking your wife or your girlfriend or something during REM sleep. So it's probably just this modulator, which is just kicking and giving you this regular spiking. So that is being faked by injecting DC current. Okay, so that's...
It also happens to be...
The network you're going to be looking at afterwards, most of those cells won't have their frequency, right? And if they fire as a result of all the energy you get from all the other cells.
So in the examples I'm going to show you, all the cells will have their own intrinsic frequency, and I'll demonstrate that. Okay, so I'm not saying this is...
It's very general. I'm just asking a question. General understanding function of the brain, you get a good starting point. The weakly coupled cells have their own intrinsic frequency when they're activated by most cells in the brain, people would agree do not function with their own intrinsic frequency. They respond to
So it's true. So I just see, I think it was my first question to Jack. I would have started differently. I also look at the motor system. and their things are very regular.
Okay.
So, and I just, any progress you can make on the nervous system is good progress.
So let me make one comment here.
Okay.
Just to make a point. So there are two ways to look at neural dynamics. One way is you look at it as if you've got switches. Everything's quiet, give it a kick, it switches on. That's fine if you're interested in fighting red models. So you're not interested in spikes as such, but just the average brain. But what's happened in the last decade and a half is people have started rightly looking at spiking neurons. And as soon as you start looking at spikes,
And this comes right out of what Bart and David are doing, for example, is you have to start treating individual neurons as oscillators and start looking at all these questions of phase resetting and so on. So this is an important methodological step. And it's actually, it doesn't really matter whether you start with neurons that are silent or ones that are present, have intrinsic currents in them. The basic mathematics is going to be the same. As soon as you start looking at spiking behavior, you're going to be in a regime like this, or in the regime that maybe Paul Breslov will talk about when he gets there, where you can actually study networks where there's strong coupling rather than weak coupling between the neurons as well.
And there, the difference between an oscillator and a Poisson distribution.
Yeah, that's right. That's
but
exactly right.
You can do them in the same time. Right.
No, but you can actually start to do that.
Okay, so I'm focusing on the oscillator guys, and they will branch off to talk about, you know, oscillators at the level of sort of chunks of tissue.
Yeah.
Right. But to the extent, but it is that very special, depending, you know, what side of the aisle you are at the neuroscience meeting, that very special, a very general aspect of neuroscience where things tend to oscillate. Okay, I'm sort of in the aisle. All right. So let's just, I mean, at this point, it's just algebra. Let's just sort of understand something. I mean, the sensitivity function is really a statement of what's happening on the postsynaptic side. How sensitive am I to my input? Let's look at the nature of the perturbation. Well, what does the perturbation depend on? Okay. So for a synapse, you know, the synapse looks something like it's a current that comes in. It looks like a conductance, right, times a voltage. Okay, so it looks like a conductance of the synapse times the voltage, okay, again, of the postsynaptic cell. Okay, the voltage has to be referenced to something, so this is the reversal of the synapse, be it it's close to zero for excitatory synapses. Okay, the other thing it depends on is the activation in the presynaptic cell, which is index J. Okay, did the presynaptic cell spike? So I could just very... for any chemical synapse, I could just write the perturbation in this form. And the reason for doing that is then when I just lump the parameters together, I get one term that looks like whether the presynaptic cell was active, and I get another term that looks like a lot of postsynaptic parameters, the sensitivity of the cell, and something that has to do with the voltage relative to the synaptic voltage, okay, on the postsynaptic side. So this is sort of like the response on the postsynaptic side, and this is like the activity on the presynaptic side. So just all I've done is algebra. And again, we can just follow along in pictures. This looks like the response on the postsynaptic side and the activation on the presynaptic side. And now you see what's coming, because I just write out this integral, and it'll turn out that this this very much just looks like the correlation of I just do a simple change of variables, and I get an integral that, you know, basically looks like the correlation over the response on the postsynaptic side and the firing on the presynaptic side. So this gets back to the question: is where did this phase difference come from? Okay, didn't necessarily have to work out that way. Okay, you could have imagined complicated synapses that depend on both pre- and postsynaptic activity, but to the extent that terms, okay, in the real synapses, okay, just divided up, right, as they did, then I could always write things in terms of this difference. And that's very nice. Then I could just take all the calculations we did before, what looks like the presynaptic activation, probability of spiring on the presynaptic side, look at our postsynaptic response curve, and I could calculate very nicely this pairwise interaction and get a little curve, right? Now, the relevance of this curve is really in considering pairwise differences. And this is kind of critical, because this will just pan right into experiment. OK.
Is it correct that I is pre and J is post?
Right. Yes.
That's the I and the J.
Right.
You lump.
Right. OK. J is post and I is pre, the way these things were defined. Wait, no. I is post and J is
right,
pre,
right,
the way things
right,
were defined. Okay, that's fine. Okay, look, so the bottom line here is that we just did a calculation and we get a form for the pairwise interaction. But really the thing we're interested in is not, this curve doesn't mean much, because what you measure in the lab is of course what the relative phase is between two cells. Okay, so let's just start with a model of two cells. And again, so we just have an equation for the time rate of change of the phase of cell I. And again, it has its natural frequency. And then it has an interaction. And then, of course, it's just reciprocally connected with its neighbor. So we get an almost identical equation, except now we've just switched I minus j. So I could look at the stability of the phase difference, right? And this just depends on the interaction phi I minus phi j minus the interaction phi j minus phi I, just the odd part of the interaction. OK, so the even part is not so important. It's just going to change the overall frequency of firing, depending on the details of the phase response curve. But the odd part is important. So I could just take this curve, right? I subtract its flip. OK, by construction, it has to have zeros at has to go through 0 at 0 and plus minus pi. OK, and now I could just look at the sensitivity. And basically, I want this is this looks like a force law. And I could ask, OK, if the phase, if one cell goes in front of the other, OK, all of a sudden the slope, right? This the interaction now goes negative. So this provides a force to push me back to this point. And the same thing here. If I phase advance of the pre minus the post, well, I can't even talk about that. OK, if j minus I pulls ahead, there's a force to push me back. So these two stable, these two points somewhat away from the origin, small phase shifts are stable, but a phase shift of 0 is unstable. So this is a strong prediction. You took two motor neurons, put them together in a dish, which hasn't been done yet, and they won't exactly phase lock with zero phase difference. They'll phase lock with a little phase difference. Okay, so it's something to chew on. Okay, now what can we do in the lab to sort of just test these basic notions? Everybody have the idea? Right, we grind through this, and we get to the point where we get a pairwise interaction, and we look at what happens of a network of two cells. Okay, and all we care is about the difference in interaction, the odd part of the interaction. Okay, and we just want to make sure that the odd part of the interaction goes negative, because that will give me a restoring force.
The sign of the interaction.
What do you mean? Oh, I'm sorry. This was taken as an excitatory synapse. I apologize. Okay, excitatory synapse. Right. So this seems to, I don't know if one could prove this. David Hansel has made a hard step in that direction. But it seems like excitatory synapses always never quite give you zero, give you locking exactly at zero. Okay. Okay, so already in the mid, sort of early 90s, there was an interesting work, some done by David Hansel and some done by Bart Ehrmantraut, part of Carl von Wrizek's thesis, where they looked at locking between neurons that made inhibitory connections. They looked in general, but they were particularly interested in phase locking between cells that made inhibitory connections. And this had not been looked at experimentally at this point. So this was sort of interesting, because the prediction came before the experiment, even though the experimentalists did not realize this. Okay. So what Carl did is he just did something very simple. He goes, well, I don't know from what the phase response curve is, but I'll choose the easiest thing in the world, which is say it's a sinusoid. Right? He means in true physics fashion, I don't know what the perturbation is, but we know what synapses do. They go up. And they go down, right? Everything in neuroscience goes up and down. So the easiest thing that goes up and down is something that looks like t e to the minus t. Okay, so you just turn the crank, and again, you solve for the odd part of this interaction, right? The thing that tells you whether these pairs of cells want to lock in phase or out of phase. And you get an expression, and the details of this expression aren't important except for one thing. There's an overall factor, which is the conductance. Okay, so it's either plus or minus, depending whether it's an excitatory connection or an inhibitory connection. And then there's a term that looks like the frequency of the oscillation times the time constant of the synapse, minus 1. So what this tells you is that at high enough frequencies, this term is positive. And at low enough frequencies, this term can go negative. Okay, so in fact, if g, okay, is negative, okay, if g is negative for inhibition, then the frequency is only stable if the time constant is very long, okay, or basically if you have frequencies that are low. So let's see what happens. OK, Okay, so this is actually recent data that came from Barry Connor's lab. And it's out of order. I'm just going to back up a second. Okay, so what Barry over the years has done a number of experiments where he's isolated only the inhibitory part of cortical networks. Now the way you do this is with drugs. Okay, you can put in drugs that block all of the excitatory transmission. So even though there's many cells that could have excitatory glutamatergic transmission, you could block these with glutamatergic blockers. So what's left are two networks of inhibitory cells, right? And they have sort of different spiking characteristics. And the details aren't important here, but it happens to be in two cells which are called fast spiking cells. And they'll just ratchet up to as high as 400 hertz, okay? And he's injected current into the cells, and he's gotten them both firing so that, in fact, their frequencies are pretty close. Okay, and what he finds is that they're actually out of phase. Okay, so it makes some sense. Omega tau is small, okay, and G is negative. So this is stable. And in fact, they're out of phase. Now, let's see what happens if we could actually make omega tau big. So this is a different set of cells, but what's happening here now, we're at 45 hertz, which if you're a frequencyologist and is known as the gamma band, okay, and the cells are out of phase. Before I showed 55 hertz, and now I've cranked up the frequency, and in fact, these guys are firing in synchrony. So for high enough frequency, these guys, in fact, the synchronous state is stable. Okay, which says that omega tau is bigger than 1 and G is negative, so this whole term is now negative. So I thought this was just absolutely remarkable data to see this on the same set of cells. Yeah? These are GABAergic synapses. Okay, so I mean, from a theoretical point of view, this derivation sort of depended on the synapses being slow compared to the time constants of the cell, which is sort of a marginal proposition in this case, but it was.
There is another way to analyze this kind of circuit that Wolfram Gerstner and Leo van Heemenen I showed.
Okay, so I'm sorry, not familiar with this.
Just look at the shape of the postsynaptic potentials. In the case of excitatory synapses, the time in which the slope of the EPSP is positive is rather short, and so the range of parameters in which you get synchrony with cross-coupled excitatory cells is quite small. But if you look at the IPSPs, the duration when the slope of the IPSP is positive is quite long. So there's a much more robust synchrony possible with mutually inhibitory synapses compared to mutually
Yeah. See, so if I draw something like this, right? Let me be careful here. Right, so the synchronous case is that they're all firing when they're maximally right depolarized, phase locked at this point. And this is also the point where they're maximally depolarized. But you're saying you're sliding on this region with positive slope.
It's much more robust to have inhibitory synapses for synchrony than excitatory. But on the other hand, Paul Breslov's not here yet, but what Paul did was he showed that as you vary the strength of the synapse, you get bifurcations and the synchronous state loses stability for a certain strength of coupling and becomes anti-synchronous.
Okay, so I didn't. There's more to this. I just wanted. It's a bit of a travelogue. I just wanted to. But I thought this was kind of, you know, a very abstract idea. You know, you go into the lab. And you make these measurements, okay? Now, there's another piece of data that supports this, and it's always nice to see data come from two groups. Eberhard, you have all this NSF money. I think you need another laptop.
Is this anti-phase stable?
What?
Is this anti-phase stable, or is he considering the...
Oh,
No, don't do that.
No, I'm just going to turn this
no,
one.
No, you don't need to.
I'm just going to get my disk out. Okay, so can you describe the other experiment in words, as since we're doing it? Maybe the CD is crummy. Try to get it out of here. The other experiment was actually, the other experiment has an interesting story. So this experiment was done post-theory. And I think what happened was is that Barry actually went ahead and he knew to look on both sides of a maximum frequency. Okay, and it was done by hand. There was another experiment that was done in Jeffrey's lab in England where they looked at slice. It was kind of a clever experiment. They looked at hippocampal slice. That's not so terribly important. You have these inhibitory cells, which means they inhibit any neighbor they could glob onto. And what they'll also do is these inhibitory cells will inhibit an excitatory cell. Now, the excitatory synaptic transmission has been quenched. So what the excitatory cells are basically readouts at this point. So what Jeffries did was he just looked at the output from the excitatory cell, okay, as a function of frequency of the networks. How do you vary frequency of the networks? Drugs, okay? So why does Valium calm everybody down? Because it increases the time constant of inhibition. And why do barbiturates actually cut? Well, one of the reasons barbiturates knock you out is that they actually decrease the time constant of inhibition. So you have this sort of plot, which is sort of a strength of inhibition versus frequency, and it goes like this. And then there's mysteriously no data. But mysteriously no data is probably the fact that the cells were actually in antiphase. Okay, but the network activity, see, and an excitatory cell, it's getting input from tens or maybe even 100 inhibitory cells. So on the one hand, their experiment, which historically came first, told you that this network could have synchronous oscillations as a network phenomena. Right, so it's sort of the n pairwise limit of what happened in Barry's data. But I just find this sort of an interesting story because rather than cook up a simple model, they used up a couple of thousand hours of multiprocessor time at IBM and they had no idea what was happening down here. And then Carl gave a little description like this one day. Okay.
My model is worth a thousand hours
of computer time. So that was kind of fun. Okay, so I think the bottom line is at the level of pairwise interactions and at the level of real cells in mammalian cortex, this theoretical idea seems to pay off. Okay, and I just...
What about a last question? I mean, in the pairwise case, they were oscillating
beautifully
at the same frequency before.
Okay, so let me...
Here, I didn't understand this one sufficiently. Do you have... What is the oscillatory... what are the oscillatory properties of the individual cells?
Okay, so these cells... So I mentioned before that in vivo... So this was also slice, right? Okay, slice is where you go up to a mouse and you say, please give me a two-dimensional slab of your brain, and the mice... It's like a mafia hit. It has no choice. And then but in order to get these cells firing, since you can't inject current into each of the individual cells, so glutamate actually acts in a way which is not just to cause ion flow, but acts in what's called a metabotrophic way, right? It will actually cause the cells to depolarize, right? So these cells have glutamate as what's called a metabotrophic receptor. I don't think that's very important, but you have to actually go in, you have to add something, right, to depolarize the entire network. Okay, so that's the condition where these cells started to oscillate. Now, whether they're all exactly at the same frequency, one can never know from this experiment. In a sense, if you isolated them, right, if you did the Gedanken experiment and isolated them, you'll never know. But at least whatever it is, the interactions are strong enough that they phase lock. Okay, so let me answer your question a little further, since...
Well,
the original computer that has 20 gigabyte hard disk, it takes a long time to fix hard disk.
Really?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to get the other disk. One sec. How do you get your disk out? Oh, here it is. You can have PC worse. Here's another copy. No, it's just Adobe Acrobat file.
But I want the answer to my questions. Can you wait for me?
Okay, now when he's gone. Okay. No, just I'll ask him later. I mean, to ask what happens, it's actually kind of, so this is where I think the thread of neuroscience is going in this direction. When you're asleep, and this part of your brain called nuclear basalis magnocellularis is off, this is what gives acetylcholine to your cortex. This is what dies the first stages of Alzheimer's. And when that's off, you get tremendous rhythmicity throughout cortex. Okay, this is well known. People with dementia have higher rhythmicity. You pick this up at MEG. Okay, and it's probably that this inhibitory network is just active, and this is what's dominating cortical dynamics. And then when you're in the aroused state, the awake and aroused state, your cortex is just splashed with acetylcholine, which is acting as a modulator, okay, on nicotinic receptors, sort of why cigarettes give you this great buzz. Okay, and at that point, for whatever, in some unknown way, okay, the fact that all these excitatory cells are now active because of acetylcholine is breaking up all the symmetry, right? So you see this switching very dramatically in the electrocorticogram. So that's the current thinking, okay? So you might, if this has any relevance to cortex, it might be just in this sleep state, but it's whatever. Okay, yeah.
I guess, I mean, why are you not considering also pair for one excites one and the other one inhibits the other?
Well, okay, I didn't do it. I mean, people have studied these, but I only didn't do it here because I just was sort of purposely windowing the data to show things that were in the spirit of these, you know, reciprocal connections moving into networks. Okay, how are we doing?
Well, I have to think you read first. It works. Yeah. The problem is it was on the CPE. You read it from the CPE.
That's all I was asking.
Well, the I mean, you know.
You can make them, I agree.
No, but this inhibitory network, which has been studied, is a reality throughout cortex. And
it's cut off.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's okay?
Well, it's not really okay, but...
It should be cut off, right?
Change the resolution.
Well, how are we cutting? Well,
I go to full screen, right? You know, full screen.
Yeah, it's just...
Full screen.
Oh, here. Anyway, control. We're fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're fine. We're fine. Okay, I'm sorry it's gotten so broken up.
Not your fault.
Okay, so just to answer your question, this network of inhibitory interneurons, it's not a number of people, and Barry Conner's lab is sort of predominant among these people, have measured from many hundreds of pairs and have sort of a distribution of inhibitory connections between these two classes of inhibitory cells. So it's not... it's not that there aren't missing connections. Okay, but it's you know, maybe 70% fully connected, which is very high, right? So I think it's reasonable to think about. Okay, and then
if you call Howell, 100 years ago, the reciprocal pair was very common. That was his main point he made. And I don't think anatomically
has
changed very much, other than they might be intervening in a neuron. But he made that 100 years ago.
Okay, I can't. Yeah, well, this, okay, I was actually...
Yeah, but this is a specialized network that...
Yeah, I'm not...
...shows synchrony.
Right. So again, it's not a theory of the brain. I'm just trying to...
And there's two of these networks in the cortex. They're right. Very prominent. Yeah. Different oscillatory frequencies.
Right.
So okay. We don't know what the hell they do. But they're up there.
But they're there.
Well, they're there, and they sort of dominate this synchronous behavior for whatever purpose it has. But I'll put that aside. Okay, so look, what I want to do now is I'm sort of... I think this sort of gives the evidence at the cellular level. So I mean, you could argue about what it does, but I personally think it's miraculous that rather simple, almost physical thinking has led to results that you could go in and test pairwise. And especially in real cortical slice, not, you know, some invertebrate cell culture, dear as that may be to my heart, okay? So now the question becomes is what, you know, how do these ideas apply on a somewhat more aggregate level, right, on the level of tissue? Okay, well, this is an experiment that's actually done this was done back at Bell Labs with various colleagues, and in particular, Kerry Delaney is responsible for working on most of the data here, and this is a preparation that this fellow Alan Gelprin sort of brought to the world. And Alan is a neuroethologist, which means that he's very good at finding an animal whose worldview is dominated by a particular trait. So if you want to study hearing, you go after an owl, right? If you want to study vision, you go after a cat. And if you want to study olfaction, you go after a garden slug, okay? Because they basically have virtually no photoreceptors, they have no hearing, okay, and odor dominates their worldview, right? It's a little bit like Tommy in the Who song, okay? And it's, so, from the physics point of view, I mean, very early on in the game, Alan was showing some data he had. He had found that this prep oscillated, and but he also had showed us some anatomical tracings, and the connections between the cells were short range. It wasn't like everybody was hooked up to everybody else. It had a sort of a small range of connectivity. So you had an oscillating system with a small range of connectivity. And the first thing that hits you over the head is that nature likes a twist, and that this thing perhaps would show waves. Okay, so we geared up to do a slightly high-tech experiment to see, in fact, if these oscillations at the level of single cells had some organized spatial structure. Okay, so this is the preparation. I'm not giving you a lot of the sort of background. This is an animal which can forage based on olfaction. It can go to its home cage with single trial learning based on olfaction. Alan was able to train it to dislike certain foods that were mixed in quinine in single trial learning. It's actually quite an amazing, I guess it's to say single trial when it works at all. Either it just sits there and dies, or it works in a single trial. It's interesting. Okay. Sort of caveat. Okay. But I think the point is that it's a structure that we could access. Yeah. There's a band of cells on top, and the band of cells is less than 100 microns thick. And optically, it's a beautiful prep. We could get access to all the cells. And therefore, we made a measurement where we didn't look at single cells, but we actually looked at the aggregate. We looked at the average membrane potential across something that was like each pixel had something like 50 to 100 cells. Okay, so it's a funny kind of measurement. And let's see what happens. So if we make this measurement, I missed everything. Okay. So the idea is very simple. We have it, like all good people who do optics, we completely false color the data, so you have no idea what's real and what's false. But we candid color net depolarization red and net hyperpolarization blue. Okay, so the one thing is, if you just sit at a given point, okay, it's just the voltage as a function of time is just going up and down. It's a very good oscillator. If I look at the entire prep at once, what I see is that there's a band of depolarization, which is sort of across the entire width of the prep, and that band of depolarization just moves. So it's just sweeping across. Okay, from tip to foot, from tip to foot. And it just does this. Okay, there's nothing else in the dish. Okay?
How does the optics reveal the voltage?
Okay, so. Yeah, so the dye, just a little physical aside for the second. So it's one of Pierre's colleagues at Yale, Larry Cohn, already 25 years ago bought 4,000 molecules in the Kodak laser dye catalog. And found that some of these actually will go into the membrane. They have fixed dipole moments. They undergo Stark shift. So the changing electric field causes a shift in the spectrum. That constitutes a contrast mechanism. Okay, so people are a little more rational today, but it's great. And what this enabled us to do is then map the voltage. So in fact, if we look at points, like one point which is at the head or the distal region, and one point is at the foot or the proximal region, in fact, we could see that there's, you know, they're basically running, you know, this is about pi. Okay, so somebody asked before, where does the famous, you know, not 2 pi come from? Okay, if we look across the entire prep, you never actually see a depolarized band, then a hyperpolarized band, then another depolarized band. And as best we can tell from every experiment that's ever been published, you the most you get is less than 2 pi. I mean, I don't know why. Maybe there's a good reason for that. Okay. The one thing that was nice about this prep, and on this, so there's two questions that come on now. Where does the oscillation come from? And as a technical issue, has our voltage-sensitive dye measurements really accounted for most of the activity in the underlying cells? Okay, so I'm going to answer these in reverse order. So we made sort of, or actually George Flores made sort of exhaustive measurements of the different cell types with a patch electrode, right? And we found that there are two types of cells. There are cells that in every cycle give out a burst. So these are multiple action potentials. These are intracellular measurements, okay? And there are other cells that are hyperpolarized, get inhibitory input with the burst. All right, so again, we have bursting cells, okay, and we have, or for lack of a better word, is non-bursting cells. Again, it's the old inhibitory network back again. Okay. Now, because of this, we know exactly what these waveforms look like. We have great intracellular records. So the question we ask is, can we take the optical signal and could we reconstruct the shape of the optical signal based on these intracellular records? All right. So in order just to increase the signal to noise a little bit, we notice that there's a symmetry. I mean, it's basically a right-left symmetry. So we really just look at the wave propagating along a band. And if it's propagating along a band, then we can make a little plot of space versus time. Okay. So this is just, now just compress all the data to one dimension. And the slope, say, of depolarization is basically the you know, is just dx by dt. It's just the velocity of the band. Okay. And this just repeats regularly, so I could just look at what a single cycle of this looks like. And then what we ask, very simply, is that there's an optical signal. And we ask, can I express the optical signal as the voltage inside these bursting cells, Vb, plus the voltage inside these non-bursting cells, and then the three free functions, okay, are the spatial distribution of bursting and non-bursting cells, something that can be checked anatomically, plus just a position-dependent phase, which gives us the speed. Okay, so we just turn the crank, and in fact, you know, you get a delay, which is relatively constant, so it just tells you the wave is going uniformly, which is what you see directly. And it gives us, and it tells us that the non-bursting cells are primarily on one part of the prep, and the bursting cells are primarily at the other part, out towards the tip. And after this data was published, Ron, I'll think of this fellow's last name in a second, in University of Montreal, actually was able to go ahead and find out that this distribution is roughly correct using anatomical, Ron Chase, using anatomical markers. Okay, so basically this is a case where optics was a good thing because we could account for the activity of most of the cells. And now the next question is, why does this thing have a wave in the first place? And so there is an experiment, and this was actually done nicest by Alan Gelprin, which there's a lot of ways you could get a wave running. And one thing we said at the beginning is that there are trivial waves, that you just have an excitation and starts and it just launches a front. Okay. As best we could tell, there was no sort of pattern generator, no driving circuit. And one way to really check for that was to take this preparation. So this is about 500 microns apart. It seems small, but it looks really big under the microscope. And then we cut it up, like prosciutto, right? And we made slabs. And each slab is about 50 microns thick on the best of days, 100 microns thick on not best of days. And what you find is that every slab oscillates. Okay, so in a sense then, maybe not every neuron, okay, but every cluster of neurons is a good oscillator. Okay. Now you can start to think very nicely of a simple model, because suppose you took oscillators which on their own had a gradient of frequencies. So on their own, this guy would like to oscillate faster than this guy, right? And then you just hook them up together with interactions, okay? If the interaction is strong enough, if the interaction is stronger than the frequency difference between pairs of cells, they'll all frequency lock, okay? And they'll phase lock, but in fact, the one that naturally has the highest frequency would be the one that wants to go first. So if this is the highest frequency end and this is the lowest frequency end, you'd expect the wave to go this way. Okay, so this is actually exactly what was found. It was really a lot of fun. So as a function of distance across the prep, we just plotted the frequency, okay? This, of course, is a typical best experiment. We plotted the frequency, okay, for each of the isolated slabs, okay? So this is the one that had the highest natural frequency, and this had the lowest natural frequency. And in fact, the propagation is in this direction. It's going from lowest frequency to highest frequency. Okay, so it was, so just sort of simple sort of phase-like thinking gave us the answer. And I'll skip the math. I mean, Bard sort of on his own went ahead and sort of worked out a simple model to explain this. Okay.
So this is what a physicist would call a quenched gradient of frequencies. And the response to that is this.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. I find that fun. And it was even, and, you know, two of us did it in separate labs. Alan's data was actually finer than our own, so I'm showing you Alan's data. Okay. So Bard made up a somewhat fancier model than certainly I could ever make up, but, in, you know, basically gets out this nice straight line. And I sort of tell him that anybody could get a straight line. But, okay, but I think this is the point. So before we saw that for certain situations at the level of pairs of cells, the phase model was a very good description. And I think already at the level of this network phenomena, which was very simple, free-running oscillations, the phase model was a very good description. Yeah?
Can you drive the slow side to make a reverse propagation?
We did a couple of experiments like this where we would drive it at a point, but it tended to stop the propagation into that region. We did a couple of uncontrolled pharmacological experiments that I'd rather not talk about, that reverse the direction of the wave. Okay. No, but you can do pharmacology. The problem is we don't quite know what exactly the pharmacology was doing and change the direction of the wave. So it's proof of principle then. You know, there's nothing here that says that you couldn't go both ways. Okay, and we also made a cut, which I didn't bring the data for. That was maybe the most dramatic thing. And you could actually see it hit the cut and then kind of go around the cut. I wouldn't say it diffracted around it, but it just went around it. So, you know, in the spirit that it's the gradient that sets the direction. If by some unknown means I can muck with the gradient, then the system seems to respond. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know why the intrinsic frequencies of different regions vary? I mean, there's a couple of explanations.
No, that's a good question. We didn't do it. I mean, you're basically saying, did we do single cell physiology and find out that, you know, some, you could imagine lots of different cards. So I didn't do it. Okay. I have to say, these are the most unpleasant cells I ever patched in my entire life because they're 5 microns in diameter. But it doesn't mean you couldn't do it. I mean, there's tricks today. You could do PCR on single cells. There's all kind of tricks. We just haven't done it yet.
Okay. The wave being there at all depends on the angle of the cut makes the slice?
No. Okay. So this isn't a slice. This is the whole prep, right? This is the whole prep. As a matter of fact, I'm not going to go into it, but you could isolate the whole prep with the nose, right? So I got a sweeper, right? You have this isolated nose. And then you could ask what the effect of olfactory input is. And I just showed this briefly. I had to just cut certain things out. But the effect of putting an odorant on is to drop the phase shift and to make the prep go mostly synchronous. Okay, and there's some idea about how this is occurring with the cells getting external excitatory input. But that's too, I just sort of wanted to stick with hard stuff. Yeah.
Okay, so that's a slice, right?
No, that's a,
That's the whole olfactory.
Yeah, that's another. That's a nice way to put it. Yeah. Okay. Look, this is a story. It's like a. I should have taken a. What? Okay. Doesn't matter. It's there's a ganglia. There's this thing called the cerebral ganglia, which sort of all invertebrates have, which have 10 to the 4 neurons. And then there are these two protuberances which hang off, okay, of the cerebral ganglia, which have about 10 to the 5 neurons. I mean, it's awesome. That's a lot of cells, okay. And what we did was in the other preps I showed you is we went and I cut right like here, okay. And sometimes we even cut off for this dynamic. Sometimes we even cut off the nose because that was a hard thing to do to keep the nose and the prep in the same dish. But so. What I've showed you before is like the part of the image I've showed you is I've just cut the imaging off here because there's no more changes, right? But it's the entire prep. If you made a slice yourself with mammalian cortex, you might make it 400 or 500 microns thick and then infinitely, you know, large in any other direction, and that's about this length. So this is a very well perfused preparation. The optics was so okay. Take a look at the prep. You're not really looking through it very well, right? So the light is actually scattering. So the optical field, when you're in the scattering regime, the you really don't have a focusing condition anymore. So the depth you get is about the width of the field. Okay, so we were about. I want to say about 30 microns or something on edge. And that's what we were looking at. Okay, all of these fields, all the intrinsic imaging experiments, I mean, people say they focus into the cortex. That's total nonsense. There's absolutely no imaging. You're just, light is diffusing in, it's diffusing out. You're seeing about as deep as you are wide. In intrinsic imaging, you're just blessed because all the blood vessels are going down radially and they're giving you information what's happening in depth. And here we're basically, you know, seeing the better part of the cell layer. We actually changed, I mean, we did mindless things like change the depth of focus and it doesn't change the result. Okay, so that was all done. It's all published, yeah. Okay,
but I also infer from what you said that it's not size that is creating this problem in the frequency.
Yeah, I mean they're all tiny, but somehow the ones that are isolated here are slower intrinsic oscillators than the ones that are isolated from there. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So. Okay. Wait. Too slow. Okay. Yeah. So these are patch recordings.
Yeah. So there are only two cells reading these preps. Can you show the density?
There must be something else because when we do this calculation, there's a little bit we can't explain, which is this. So there's a little something else that I don't know, but it's. I have to divide. It's, you know.
Given cell type, the numbers, there's not much variability.
Oh. No. Okay. This is taken from an intact preparation. So they're all frequency locked. Okay. So there's very little. I mean, if I put all the waveforms on top of each other from all.
All right. They're already from intact prep. I understand. So they're not individual cells.
Right. But. I mean, we didn't do any kind of statistics. We put them on top of each other. It was really one of these cases. It was just so obvious that they're one type or the other. You know, it wasn't some, okay, yeah. Okay, so I think it's a great prep. Okay, any other questions? Okay. Okay, so I want to move on, and I just want to go up the phylogenetic tree a little bit, and talk about what happens in the visual system. Okay, now these are experiments that were done in the visual system of turtle. If you have any doubts about the visual system of turtle, then you should just put a goldfish in the turtle tank and just, I mean, these guys are brutal. I mean, they're worse than your colleagues at faculty meetings. I mean, they just go for the fish. Okay, now a little bit about the neuroanatomy of turtle. Okay, why did we choose this preparation? Again, our focus here is on dynamics. We chose it because Ted Bullock and his then postdoc, Jim Prechtel, had found that in the presence of visual stimulation, you get oscillations in turtle visual cortex, which I'll explain in a second. Okay, now this was also, they had this finding about the time that Charlie Gray, Wolf Singer, and many people in Wolf's lab were publishing about oscillations in the cat, but it is, and it's, I think it maybe things are just barely changing now. Technically, it was technically impossible, certainly at the time, to do voltage-sensitive dye imaging on single trials into the cat because of blood flow. Okay, I could go into this in gory detail for anybody who wants to get into this. But on the other hand, this was a nice preparation, and what Ted, and actually quite some years ago, Ford Ebner and Herbert Kalacki, who's at UC Irvine, had showed that if you go up and you just have like a startle stimulus, like you put a block, right, just in front of the eyes of the turtle, that this was an extremely effective stimulus at causing plasticity, all right, within the response, the head withdrawal response to the animal. And Ted and Jim had already showed that this thing oscillates, and again, the only way to look at the spatial dynamics here was to look at the large-scale pattern, okay, because, you know, the oscillation isn't locked to anything, it's free-running. Okay, so you sort of got the theme. You need something you could look at and you could analyze in single trials. Okay, so what's the visual system of turtles? So we're all used to thinking of V1, and you know, visual physiology is dominated by being able to ask, you know, what was that object? Okay, that was, you know, whatever. That was a green 1976 Mustang, you know, with headers, right, that went by. But if a car is about to run you over, you couldn't care less what the car is, right? You want to be sensitive to motion, and you want to be sensitive to novelty, okay? And there's sort of this other visual pathway, okay, which goes sort of directly in monkeys, in man, to area MT, okay, that goes through what's called the pulvinar system. And this is what really drives our response to novelty and our response to motion. Okay, so I'd rather have that work and my being able to identify cars fail than vice versa. Now, the pulvinar system somehow didn't make it into the visual system in Kandel and Schwartz, but that's not my problem. But the visual system in the turtle is, if there's any sort of rough analogy, it's analogous to this sort of motion enter, you know, medial temporal aspect of the mammalian visual system. And it's also, it differs in the mammalian visual system because this is old cortex. Okay, like hippocampus, it's three layers. It hasn't refolded to make sort of modern six-layer neocortex. Nonetheless, there was some very nice mapping. Most of this work dates to Phil Ulinski, in which you find that there's an area that responds very, very nicely to visual stimulus. Okay, and there's a neighboring area, these are called dorsal areas 1 and 2, that responds not very well to visual stimulus and therefore serves as a control. Okay, now the great thing about the turtle as an experimental animal is that you could actually stop the supply of oxygen, purposely or accidental, and the whole turtle does not just die in 20 seconds, but the brain shuts down. Okay, and then if you revive the supply of oxygen, it turns on again. So this allowed us to remove the blood, okay, and add an oxygenated saline with various goodies, right, to keep up the turbidity of the saline. And this, in fact, allowed us then to do an imaging experiment. Okay, I'm just going to skip these. Did a couple of studies with arrays of electrodes just to show that, in fact, the system behaves sort of as columns of oscillators. Okay, and that if you look on short distances, you could really see what I'll show you later are phase shifts. So let me just sort of jump to the chase. And the chase is that we could look at the entire turtle brain at once in the presence of a stimulus, okay? And we did this, again, using the same technology of optical imaging. This is a collaboration with Jim Prechtel from Ted Bullock's lab, as well as Partha Mitra, who who's now Cold Spring Harbor, and Larry Cohn, who's at Yale, who started this technology. And what we do is, if we look at a given point, we put a stimulus on, and you see two things. You see a big step, a big depolarization, and you see a lot of wiggles. Okay. Well, the big depolarization is just the whole cortex turning on, and we're not particularly interested in that. Okay. So we filter that out. We do standard sort of trick using median filter. And we end up with a lot of wiggles. And then it becomes sort of a question, do all these wiggles at all these different points, okay, are these somehow the signature, okay, of a wave moving across cortex? Okay, well, we can look at the wiggles in a little bit of detail. And what we see, in fact, is that before the stimulus comes on, we look at the power spectra. So this tells us how much energy there is in different frequency bands. And it's pretty banal, okay? And if we look at the power spectrum after the stimulus comes on, we see a peak at 18 hertz or close to 20 hertz. Now, this is what actually was found previously, that when you put a visual stimulus on, the system will start to oscillate. So that's the good news. The bad news is that there's power at all these other frequencies, okay? And it's big, and it's going to swamp this. Okay, but so we have to do a little trick. And the little trick is that we're going to have to extract out only what happens at this frequency band. So there's a couple ways to do this. Okay, so again, if you just take the unprocessed data, and this is a case where this moving stimulus came on. The stimulus has no frequency components. It's just a moving block that's going after the animals. You can't really tell much from looking at the raw data. You see some kind of excitation that has a function of time, where about 10 milliseconds between frames is moving over. It's not very exciting data, not very easy to quantify. So we're going to do two things, and I'll just sketch them, and I could go over stuff in detail later. The first thing is that we know that this prep was oscillating at 18 hertz. I want to find the change in the spatial pattern at 18 hertz. So I treat each pixel as a time series, and I demodulate it against a reference at 18 hertz with a certain bandwidth associated with it. Okay. And then if I do that, the only thing that survives in this demodulate is the amplitude of the demodulate and the phase of the demodulate. So I plot them. And just for clarity, what I do is the amplitude is plotted as a saturation, how deep the color is, and the phase is color-coded. If the entire brain is going up and down at 18 hertz, I should see one color, right? Just constant phase. If there's a wave, a linear wave, I should see a gradient of color, right? Because different phases. If there's a rotating wave, then I should see something like a kid's pinwheel, okay, or a color palette, okay. So what's going on? The stimulus came on here. Not much action. Not much action. Not much action. Finally, stimulus comes on at 4 seconds. Finally, gets in the field of view. We see roughly a linear gradient. Okay, it's formed. Okay, that corresponds to a linear wave. A nice way to look at it, I don't know if you like to go hiking and stuff, is you just make a topo map, and the lines of constant phase. So you can either look at it and say it's complicated or it's simple, but the dominant thing is kind of a constant phase. Okay, time marches on. We finally get to a point where, again, a simplicity reveals itself, and we're just walking around this little color palette. And the little color palette then has a focus. So this corresponds to a rotating wave. And again, for simplicity, sometimes it pays just to look at the phase, and we see, you know, something that looks like this. Looks like a topo map of Mount Whitney, okay? So it basically means you're going, you know, the full 2 pi all the way around, okay? And then as time marches on further, it comes back to something that approximates a linear phase gradient. So this is what happens, this is an animal, it's an awake animal. You know, it's an invertebrate. And the NIH doesn't believe these are real animals. You can use awake animals. And this is during normal visual task, okay, for which the animal will try to move its eyes if it wasn't, or withdraw its head. Okay, you actually have this choreography of a wave of activity, okay, and plus this rotating wave of activity. Okay, so if you repeat it again and again, you don't exactly, you know, the rotating wave doesn't exactly start at the same time, but the choreography repeats. Okay, that's why you have to look at single trials. What? Yeah. Okay, this is correct. So this is, I mean, I So I'm going to mislead you. I said we never saw more than 2 pi.
More than pi.
Did I say pi?
Yeah.
I apologize. I apologize. Okay.
Now, the previous thing that you had showed us, had all the noise, was just an average. Is that the point?
This is just the unprocessed data.
Right. So what does unprocessed data mean? It means
just you have all temporal frequencies are present.
But what was the signal? It was a spatial average?
Oh no. Okay, the signal in each is we have a voltage. Each pixel is a time series of voltages, is of a fluorescent changes, which are equivalent to a time series of.
This is a power spectrum.
This is a power spectrum of the average of the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry.
Right.
I'm sorry. Yes.
So the answer was yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Well, this was done on a photodiode array.
Yes.
And then he filtered out the 18 hertz.
Yeah. Okay, so this is a technical point, but I just wanted to make sure I don't jump too quick into some heavily processed data. Okay, so you can see this, things aren't static, that they're moving, but it's very hard to discern what's happening. Okay, so I think this is sort of a general analysis problem. You have a couple of processes going on at once, and this is a case in which they separate out nicely in the frequency domain, even though they're complicated in the time domain. Yeah?
When you see the rotating, how many turns do you see?
Well, one and a, yeah, one, one to, you know, it comes back, you know, it lasts for much longer. It lasts for maybe 4 times 1 over 20 hertz. That was, so it's stable. I mean, it's stable.
Like a
yeah.
Turn.
Yeah.
How does it disappear?
Well, I don't know. It just breaks up into some other structure. The phase just rearranges itself. I don't know what more to say.
Other frequency bands and look at
that. Yeah. Okay. I'll get to that next slide.
Just
yeah.
Sorry.
No. Please.
Terrible when you throw data in front of people.
Sorry.
You've got about. These are about 8. This looks like about the period of 18 hertz going across.
This is 24 and 5th, it's like 75 milliseconds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's like, each of these are like 10 milliseconds.
Yeah, so one of the things you might get, David, is you'll have spurious associations because you'd be modulated to 18 hertz. So every once in a while, statistically, you'll get things that will appear to be coherent and then disappear.
No. Let me just answer that a second. I will make sure I'm not shortchanging myself. Each of these is averaged over. Each of these is averaged over a full bandwidth, which is like 1 over 20 hertz, which is like 50 milliseconds. So even though I'm showing them. No, it's average. Each of these is average over a half bandwidth, which is 25 milliseconds. Okay, I don't know how you would just. I don't believe what you say that if these were just random that I would get something with such a high correlated state. I mean, I could gladly take the data and shuffle it, but yeah, I don't think that's true. I mean, there's like 500 pixels here. This is not spurious. Okay.
Demodulize if it's a trace log, should be one color. Demodulize in a way.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing when you demodulate. We don't put in the fact that pixels are next to each other. It's not. That's not known, right? At all. That never comes into this analysis. Okay. And then let me answer Jack's question. I'll go back if we want to discuss this further. So. There's another way to analyze this data that comes from the it's a common geophysics technique, but it just asks, let's look at the whole 4-second response and ask, what's the typical pattern? What's the typical pattern? And the way to ask that is to say, well, what we're really asking is we have an oscillator, and there's an oscillator, we have multiple oscillators, right? We want to ask, if they tend to shift frequency together, then it's coherent. If they tend to shift frequency, on the average, okay, without tracking each other, then it's incoherent. So that defines a measure. Now, In fact, I have 5 seconds of data, so that's a fifth of a hertz, and I set up a bandwidth of something like 3 hertz, so that means I have 15 things I could average, 15 degrees of freedom. Okay, so I'm going to average over all those degrees of freedom, and then what you find out, before the stimulus came on as a function of frequency, there was really maybe just a little bit of a coherent pattern at low frequency. And the spatial pattern that this corresponds to is shown here. Okay, so I'll get to what this means in a second. When the stimulus comes on, given this measure of coherence, do the oscillators move together? Okay, I get peaks at a number of different frequencies. So let's just look at the lowest frequency ones when the stimulus came on. It turns out it's in about the same direction as the pre-stimulus peak. It turns out that this direction corresponds to the direction of the afferents from dorsal thalamus to dorsal cortex. Okay, so this is not so surprising. There's some flow of information. Okay, we thought that was actually a good thing. Okay, the other thing is if we look at these other peaks. So we looked at there's a peak in coherence at 8 hertz. There's one at 18 hertz. There's one at 23 hertz. Okay, and we just look at what spatial pattern. So this is the average direction. So there's no rotation here because this is just the typical, right? In fact, at 18 hertz, we get a gradient. Not surprising, is to get about the same gradient that these other frequencies. I'm not quite sure what to make out of this. This is the next trial, so you get the same gradient. It's not exactly the same, but this is the reality of this experiment. Okay, after the fact, it turned out that Phil Ulinsky had done an interesting experiment where he had injected, you know the way anatomists work, they inject a big blotch of dye into the cortex, they see what fibers took it up, and then they map the direction of all the fibers. Okay, so this is really something that's on should go between 0 and pi, but it's, I don't know, it's plotted 2 pi. Okay, but they found out that there's a little bit of a bias. Okay, whether you believe this hump or this hump, the claim is that it's somewhat above the background. So there's a bias in the direction of the axonal fibers that comes from this track tracing experiment. And the direction of that bias is in the same direction as the optical imaging. Okay, so it's sort of a trivial answer here for why we actually get a wave is that there's actually a bias in the connectivity. But it can't be the whole story because we get a rotating thing. So in principle, then the excitation, as in Lymax, could go in any direction. Okay?
And the scatter is the degree to which these are not identical.
The scatter?
The two.
Right. Right, so that probably tells you, here the peak is, the difference here is on the size of the peak. It tells you it's kind of a signal to noise of one or two experiment, right? That's all. So I'm not making a big deal, but it's a clear bias. Okay.
So you interpret a wave based on this as spatially re-entering on the propagation?
That's consistent with this, yeah. Okay. Okay, we'll forget the model. Okay, so let me explain where things are sort of going. There's some data that mostly came from a fellow named Peter Rolsema in Will Singer's lab. I didn't bring the data with me. I was a little bit selective. It's basically two-point measurements. And I think the point is they did a number of experiments where the animals had to attend on an object. These are awake behaving cats. And it's a little difficult to interpret because it's field potential measurements measured from a single point. And of course, as you roll your electrode throughout the depth of cortex, you will get phase changes depending whether you're mostly in regions of excitatory or inhibitory synapses. So the only way to do this right is by having an array of many electrodes, which, okay. But nonetheless, there was already some indication that at least the timing between different parts of cortex changes as the animal's behavioral state changed from attending to an object to resting between trials. This also coincided with changes in frequency. Okay, so the interpretation isn't clear, but I think what is clear is that as a matter of proof of principle, you do get changes that go from areas being synchronous to areas being asynchronous, okay, during normal vision. But it's only two-point measurements. We are trying to make these measurements as we work in the Ratt-Vibrissa system. Okay, there's been a couple of non-trivial technical aspects, the one being the blood flow. Okay, this has sort of turned into its own life. We became blood flow measurement experts, and it's been great fun. But that's not the topic of this talk. Okay, so hopefully in a little bit of time, we'll have very nice data trying to measure these interactions in the mammalian cortex at a place where we really know horizontal connectivity very, very well. Okay, so I think this is, so what I tried to do, I'll cut it off, and I think it's already 3:30. If somebody's interested, I could talk about nonlinear mixing. It was a lot of fun. So, but if you, do you want me to spend 10 minutes or?
If you'd like to.
Is anybody interested in this? Okay, so let me just cut it off here. I think this is the state of the art, okay? I showed you data. These are facts, okay? It is a religious belief on my part that this notion of weakly coupled oscillators has something to offer neuroscience. Okay, I mean, it really, I thought, was very inspiring that, you know, a couple of serious biological laboratories took this stuff seriously and used it, and it sort of forced them to take things like brain slice and actually try to simplify it and actually try to get at the kernel of some subcircuitry, right? It's very rare to be, there's not too many stories in neuroscience where theory actually drove people to change their viewpoint. And I think this has. So I'm just, it's something to keep in mind. Okay, it's not a theory of the brain, but it's a way, I think, to understand certain dynamics. Okay, so. All right, if it crashes, blame this on Eberhard. If it crashes, we'll blame it on Eberhard.
Okay.
What?
Okay, the one on the upper left-hand corner, which will now be. There's a kind of approximate symmetry, which I see no reason for it to be there, so I didn't want to say it before, but I just wanted to point it out. If you take a northeast-southwest slice in the middle of the map.
Okay, wait, north?
Yeah.
North? East.
Southwest.
Just, yeah, like this.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you reflect the data, go half a period advance, and then change and multiply by -1, so you're red and blue.
Sounds like one of these NPR game shows, right?
I think you'll find that that's pretty close to.
Okay, but another way to say it is that since I'm measuring let's see, the box is, I can't see it well, it should be up there, and the little triangle is down here. You're saying I could take this waveform, these waveforms you're saying are symmetric. They are pretty close to symmetric. I don't know what to do with it.
I don't know either, but I can figure out why the spatial symmetry would be important in what you're doing, but it was just something that struck me as the data was going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to say. Yeah. Well, kind of on purpose. Yeah, that's always the bias. Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's a phenomenology that, I mean, it seemed very interesting at the time, but since I don't really understand its function. Okay. So basically, when an odor comes in the presence of an odor, okay, we did this with a number of odorants. The entire prep becomes synchronized. Okay. Briefly. And we did this, like, this is just a measure. I'm just looking at the correlation between this point and this point. And I'm just saying, so, you know, instead of these two points, the way I happen to have picked them, we're, you know, pi to two out of phase. And, you know, basically the prep becomes almost synchronous. But I don't, I mean, you might say that's great. It's an odor detector, and if I just have a voltmeter and I hook it up to two sides of the prep, I could just read out the synchrony, and it tells me an odor came. And but I really don't know if that's the way the animal does this. I'm quite serious. Okay. So it's just, it seemed that, like, if I make any analogy to what's based on literally a two-point measurement in the cat, which is Peter Relsema data, when a stimulus is present, which means the animal is attending, okay, it's synchronous. And when the stimulus is taken away, it's asynchronous. I'm sorry, I just didn't bring the data. That's very clear. It's actually in this little paper with Bard. We were really struck by it. We would have them send all our data, their data to us. They're very grateful, gracious about this. Okay, but I don't think that's, it's not the best way to tell that something is there, just to switch the phase, because then you need, it's not a readout. You need something to read this out. I mean, a readout is something that in principle could activate a collection of motor neurons. So this guy, so the Limex likes to get its odor into the air, but the prep has to be underwater. So he had a diving board, and the prep was stapled to the diving board from underneath, and then the nerve went around the side, and it had a nose on top. And, you know, we're imaging from below. It's not that complicated. Anyway, we like this stuff, right? We're experimentalists, right? And then we puff odor from the top. And then, like, in order to make sure it's not just the air, right, you have air sort of, you have moisturized air blowing continuously, and you inject odor into the airstream. Right, that's fairly standard.
The implication is that this is the average relative phase averaged over the whole sample.
Okay, this.
You described it as being just 3 points, but it could be that you're just that there's still a lot of phase difference, but it's just not between those 2 points.
No. Okay,
So it would have to be sort of the average of the whole sample.
Okay, so I really apologize for not bringing it, but let me just describe it since I know it well. I mean, if you actually looked at the prep, what you would see is one color, okay, which means that the whole prep goes to a single phase, okay, and then just as a way to draw a line drawing, okay, I just, you know, we have a point here and a point here. It just seems a way to sort of look at the progression as a function of time, okay, but there's an instant in time where if I looked, you know, nominally between any 2 points, whatever distance they're apart, everybody's in phase. So it constitutes a readout, right, of an odor. But I don't think it solves a problem, because then you have to read out the readout. Now, you could say that what neurons do is they correlate. I mean, that's the one thing that different inputs do. So you could have a neuron that was looking at both parts of the prep, okay, and that only fired, okay, when the front and the back were in phase together. The sad story is nobody found a cell for that. Now there is one thing that has to do with the wave, which is worth bringing up. There's a couple of papers that came out of Japan, and one of them was actually very nice. And what they found is that neurons in the presence of an odor, neurons would just tend to take up a dye. Okay, it sounds funky, but it just means if the neurons had increased activity, that they were recycling more and more transmitter. Right, and neurons will just eat anything. I mean, you could dump, you know, whatever it is, these 100 angstrom latex beads, and they'll just, like, they're like little garbage machines, right? Like, sort of like your kids, right? And they just eat everything. And then, so what happened is they would dump different odors on them, and they would get bands in different locations due to different odors. Okay, so that was a pretty dramatic result. Right? It was published in Journal of Neurophys, which doesn't get as much press as it should. And that led to another unproved idea, which actually had its origins in a comment from Boris Schramm, that it's a little bit like the checkout counter at Vons, or I don't know, wherever you buy your food, in that different neurons, for some reason, okay, respond to different odors. So it means like the receptor cells for different neurons, okay, for different olfactory receptors, would come onto different parts of the prep. And then the wave is actually just sweeping, okay? So you can't somehow sample, right, all parts of the, you can't somehow sample the entire odor space in one shot, right? That you have to sample it sequentially. It's an old idea, actually. So synchronization
with DNA from that register that was on the
Well, the bands are like this, so it's the I don't understand the connection with the synchrony. It's part of the reason I didn't mention it, but it's just that you had preferential odor inputs to different parts of the prep in a band structure, right? And then you had this wave, so it looks like it's sort of sampling different odors. If you just put these two experiments together, they had no dynamics in their experiment; they just had the static pattern. We have dynamics, but we couldn't do the static measurement at the same time.
You could show different orders and see how it synchronizes, how dynamically you go from the wave.
Well, we did put different orders on, and the only thing we see that are different is that if it's an odor the animal likes, the frequency has a tendency, there's a small frequency shift that goes along with this, which I didn't mention, and the frequency tends to go up significantly, and if you put an odor on which is adversive, it's like quinine, which is, I mean, it's pretty bad. It's like jumping into a pool with too much chlorine. The frequency actually goes down. But so there's kind of hints, right? The idea of subsampling was something Jerry Wetfan actually mentioned a long, long time ago. I noticed you didn't talk about it.
It's actually before Jerry.
He talked of, okay.
No, I mean, before Jerry thought of that, some of his sampling, subsampling ideas were
around
McCulloch.
I see, because the human, the optic nerve actually has a range of speeds, and the frog nerve, he mentioned this in terms of the frog nerve. So you see a visual scene, and then that scene is actually coming onto the tectum spread out over a period of time. So, I mean, this is just an idea. It's that you can't process all the sensory information in one shot. So you're just chunking it, okay? But there's no real proof for this, okay? There's no real proof.
It's an old idea that goes back to Pitts, actually. Pitts and
McCulloch. That's fine. Okay, thanks.